Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. As I've mentioned, I'm still coming to you from Taiwan. Keep praying for our mission. We're having tremendous fruit, tremendous joy in engaging in this very needed work of the proclamation of the gospel to people who frankly don't know about Jesus Christ and his church and don't even know that their lives matter. So this is an important truth that is worth preaching. Every one of us ought to evangelize the world in one way, shape, or form to make sure that Jesus' truth goes to the ends of the earth, especially on social media and the digital world. Now, in this hour, I'm going to be talking with my friends Dr. Greg and Lisa Popchek. Last month on the Good News Cruise, I gave a talk, and that talk is going to be uploaded soon. The talk was exploring 12 ways that Satan attacks marriage. But knowing the enemy's plan is only half the battle. We must know how to engage them. Now, when I wrote the plan, the 12 ways in which Satan attacks marriage was not novel. It was just the result of years of, I've been doing this for about 18 years now, and so years of preaching on the covenant and marriage across the world and seeing very similar threads to the complaints, the struggles, the issues that married couples are facing. And then in my encounters and conversations with Greg and Lisa, I've seen that they are dealing with the very same issues, and they tackle it from the perspective of therapy and psychology and the theology of the body. And so we join together to talk about these 12 ways that Satan attacks marriage. And I was actually amazed at how many people benefited from hearing that talk and knowing how to move forward. We go on from there to speak with Lee Sneed. Those suffering from infertility often do so in silence, in isolation, and sometimes even shame. Some married couples find the suffering so raw and very intimate that they don't share with even each other. They don't lean on each other. And that's a problem that many modern couples are facing. It's a real cross, and that cross can look very different, even in the same category of infertility. Well, Lee Sneed has experienced this firsthand with her husband, Carter, and she's penned a book about exactly this issue. And it's about finding fulfillment when you can't conceive, and we talk with her about unpacking and acknowledging this issue. Let's look at the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, March 10th. It's the Feast of St. Marie Eugenie de Jesus. Today's news brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need. VisitingAngels.com. Pope Leo is said to be following the conflict unfolding in the Middle East with concern. Rory O'Neill reports.
According to a statement from the Vatican, Pope Leo is praying for the bloodshed to end. It said the pontiff expressed his sorrow for the many innocent people who have died, including children and those who care for them. Those caught up in the conflict so far include a Catholic priest killed in Lebanon. Father Pierre El-Rahi was killed by Israeli tank fire in a southern village as he rushed to aid parishioners. I'm Rory O'Neill.
Cardinal Dominic Matthew has confirmed that he has fled Iran and is now in Rome, along with the staff of the Italian embassy. No one has been able to communicate with Cardinal Matthew since the war began, including the bishops in neighboring countries. There are nearly 3,500 Catholics in Iran. According to Vatican statistics, only three priests were in the country in 2024, and Cardinal Matthew has served as pastor of Tehran's five parishes. The Pope has accepted the resignation of the San Diego bishop accused of stealing money from his church. Jack Cronin with more.
Pope Leo has accepted the resignation of Bishop Emmanuel Shaletta, who was arrested at San Diego International Airport while prosecutors say he was trying to leave the country. The 69-year-old bishop entered a not guilty plea in court after being accused of stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars from St. Peter's Chaldean Catholic Church in El Cajon. He faces up to 15 years in prison if convicted.
Shaletta has pled not guilty to charges of embezzlement and money laundering. A man said to be executed Thursday is having his sentence commuted to life without parole. Alabama Governor Kay Ivey intervening, saying the execution of Charles Burton would be unjust. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm talking with Leigh Fitzpatrick Sneed. She's the author of Infertile But Fruitful, Finding Fulfillment When You Can't Conceive. And for many of you who listen to this program, you know full well that my own personal story with my bride involves such a situation. And therefore, this book, when it was brought to our attention, was something that was so near and dear to my heart. And undoubtedly, many of you listeners as well who have called in and shared. And so I thought this would be an important conversation. Leigh is a fellow for the Catholic Association and co-host of the nationally syndicated radio show Conversations with Consequence, author of Infertile But Fruitful, Finding Fulfillment When You Can't Conceive, writer, editor, speaker, and mother of four, whose work engages questions of pop culture, motherhood, family, and the church. Leigh, thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
Thank you. I'm very well. Thank you for having me on.
I'm very, very glad to be able to speak with you about this. I want to begin by, I read the book, and so I want to give you the room to just share the story that prompted the need to write this book.
Sure. You know, it was, at this point, I think it was a few years ago, maybe three, I wrote an article for the National Catholic Register during Infertility Awareness Week. I also wrote one around Mother's Day. And those were like my first sort of tiptoeing into the professional infertility mode, because I mean, I obviously had personally been infertile for a long time, but I hadn't really talked about it. You know, I mean, as you know, it's very personal. It's like the most personal part of your life. But then I got such a positive, like voluminous response to both of those pieces. A lot of DMs, this helped me. You know, I was up in the middle of the night, and actually this story is really great because it's a two-part good. I was up in the middle of the night, my wife is so sad, we haven't been able to conceive. I was just Googling and I found this letter, and it helped me. This was an email to my husband, and he saw my this person who read it saw my last name, realized he had been a student of my husband's. And that's created like a beautiful, like sort of post student teacher relationship friendship after that, because I think, again, you'll probably know this too, that sometimes men are overlooked in this. But anyway, the response was really big. A lot of people DM'd me, people I knew, people I didn't know. Priests were like, I'm going to save these articles because people come to me. Sometimes I don't know what to do. I can at least start by sharing this with them. And then I had a mentor who said, hey, I think this is your book. And Sophia seemed to think so too. Sophia Institute Press. And so here we are.
Well, like I said, I'm really glad you penned the book. And it's a tremendously accessible read. And like you mentioned, it's deeply personal. And since you brought it up, maybe that might be a good place to start before we dive into the content of your book. You mentioned how men experience this. And in my experience, it's almost as if men are expected to not feel it and not talk about it. And frankly, even for me, my whole drive has been to be strong for my bride.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that it was tearing us up inside, both of us.
Yeah, and you want to protect her, and you want to do whatever it takes to make sure that she's okay, and that's so beautiful. And I actually have to say, I'm just tickled to death by the fact that you call her your bride, because my husband does the same thing. Every time he like reposts an article, he was like, here's the latest from the bride. So anyway, I love that. And yeah, I think so, and that's why I was so happy. The section, you know, where I have other people's stories, I had cast kind of a wide net, you know, because you sort of, I don't know if you've found this to be true, but you kind of pick up, you know, a posse of fellow infertile people, like along the way. You meet people, you have a special rapport, you can talk about things that like only you guys really understand, you can talk in shorthand. And I have found a really wonderful, like supportive stable of these dear friendships. And I asked 8 or 9 of them if they'd be willing to share some or part of their own stories for my own book, because I wanted sort of different flavors of infertility represented, not just my own experience. And what was really interesting was that only 3 were able to answer the questions I asked, because some of them, it was too painful to revisit, or maybe they had never actually dealt with them themselves, but that's a side point. The point is that 2 of them talk explicitly about their husbands and what it takes to, you know, the reminders to women that he suffers too. And especially, you know, one AB, she wanted to be anonymous because it's so private. She talks about, you know, they experienced male factor infertility. And again, I think there's an assumption out there that it's twofold, that it's usually the woman, because it's the woman who isn't pregnant. So that's sort of the obvious mm-hmm. thing. And then also, I think, you know, all this sort of just, I mean, it's not contemporary bro culture, but this sort of hyper masculinity thing, like, it's just a medical diagnosis, but I think people really feel emasculated by mm-hmm. that. And I think that's my, I felt like less of a woman when I was going through it. I mean, I think it really gets at the heart of so many things about yourself. But I do think, as little as people talk about the female experience of infertility, it's less with men. So whether, and also I think, you know, as Catholics, it's the couple that has it. But I think also, I just think, again, I think that your instincts to protect and care for your wife, the bride, are the same for everyone else. I think that it's more comfortable to reach out to the woman in the infertile couple yeah. for them. Sort of women, I think, you know, you mother them, they mother you back. It's, I don't know, I think it's less common for people to know how to, like, reach out and comfort the man in the couple. I don't know. This is, it's all anecdotal. I'm not an anthropologist or anything, but, you know, no. You could probably have some insights on that too.
No, I appreciate you speaking into it in that way, especially from the perspective of a bride. And because of that, I want to, so I'll share briefly. For us, it was, we got married, and, you know, before marriage, you don't know what you don't know, because
right. you've never exactly.
been with each other, right? And so you're figuring all of these things out for the first time. And then a year goes by, and then 2 years go by, and you start really asking questions because you don't know what's wrong.
Right. Almost like, are we doing it right?
Yes.
This was supposed to be easy, you know?
Because, you know, I taught high school for a while, and in my short time of my short career teaching high school, these teenagers were
yeah.
without any effort, right? And so we're looking at each other going, what are we doing wrong?
Yeah. No, I know. And there was, yeah, I mean, there was a time when it just was just drilled. I went to public school and it just drilled into you that, like, unintentional pregnancy was everywhere out to get you. So the idea that it would be possible to, you know, just go for it and have you not get pregnant was, you know, crazy. And then, yeah, again, you don't know what to do with it because everything's new. You're still figuring it out. I mean, my husband and I were really young. We'd known each other since we were even younger, but we were still, you know, kids. And all of a sudden, and, you know, I remember thinking, like, but we just seem fertile. Like, that was my...
yes.
We look fertile. You know, like, I feel fertile. And obviously that means nothing, but, yep. you know, I think when, yeah, it really turns all your presuppositions about what your future is going to be, like, upends them. And I think that's the big part that I think people don't understand, because I think, and that's, I think, what leads people to be like, oh, just adopt.
Mm-mm.
As if it's that easy. Or maybe,
oh, yeah, gosh.
Or as if you haven't heard of adoption before. Or like, you should get this test, or you should, like, yeah, I got it. You know, and again, people want to help.
Mm-hmm.
But again, if you haven't walked through it or walked along somebody who's done it, it's really hard to understand how just destabilizing it is to a marriage, to your future, to what your plans were, even, like, in fact, like, your career plans, schooling plans, everything, you know? Yeah, I mean, you know.
No, I completely understand. I am talking with Leigh Sneed. She's the author of Infertile But Fruitful. She's also the radio host of the nationally syndicated program, Conversations with Consequence. And this book, Infertile But Fruitful, it really is an amazing, simple, heartfelt take on a largely unspoken struggle. And that's why we're having this conversation on this program today. It is published by Sophia Institute Press. Do procure a copy of it and have this conversation. I think we ought to change the stigma around this conversation. We're continuing on the other side of the break. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Today's programming is brought to you in part by a gift from our day sponsor. The annual Rose Mass for Catholic healthcare workers, celebrated by Bishop Boyer, takes place on Saturday, March 14th at 5 p.m. at St. Francis in Ann Arbor, followed by a dinner reception. Dr. Bob Collins, nationally recognized oncologist, will share his journey of conversion and stories of grace and healing. Suggested donation is $25. RSVP at bit.ly/rosemass.
Catholic Charities of Shiawassee and Genesee Counties have been providing help and creating hope since 1941. It's the generosity of donors that allows them to provide necessary services such as their warming center, which provides refuge and comfort to thousands in our community. They also offer hot meals in their soup kitchens and help families make ends meet in their community closet. Even the smallest donation makes a meaningful difference. Join us in their mission by giving a donation at CatholicCharitiesFlint.org.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
This program is brought to you by the following nonprofit underwriter.
Are you longing to hear God's voice? Lord, Teach Me to Pray, the free Ignatian Prayer Series will open your heart to His voice, to the peace you are seeking and the only love that fulfills the human heart, Jesus. God is calling you to true joy, knowing Jesus personally. Lord, Teach Me to Pray is free. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com, click on the red box, order the Lord, Teach Me to Pray series now. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm talking with Leigh Sneed, the author of Infertile But Fruitful, Finding Fulfillment When You Can't Conceive. So your first chapter, that's so funny because back in middle school, you hear the first comes love, then comes marriage, then comes so-and-so pushing baby carriage. And I think we've created a bit of a social structure, like you mentioned, of accidental pregnancies and easy pregnancies.
Yeah.
And I want to invite you to speak to that social mindset and how that impacts and affects families, young couples who are having legitimate struggles today with conceiving and having children.
Yeah, I do think that that's, especially when you are in sort of a really vibrant Catholic community, you know, that focus on, you know, chastity and marriage and, you know, the procreative and the unitive, and there's, you know, large families at Mass, and there's just so much. If you see it, you want it. What we need to do is we need to be able to talk. I mean, it's funny because I say this sometimes and then I think, do we really want to talk about it as much? Women talk about their pregnancy and birth stories for years, decades even, as if they had just happened. And it would be nice if there was that sort of freedom to talk about your infertility story too, in, you know, like groups of women or wherever you might have that conversation. But I think there's such a strange, people, I think, sometimes even think it might be catching. Like, I think people, you know, that there's jokes about like divorce being catching or something, and they don't want to talk about it. They're uncomfortable. And, you know, I think that they don't ever sort of really ask you questions, or they ask you really invasive questions. And so I think this takes practice. The more we talk about it, the more we have a common vernacular, the more we understand that everyone has crosses. I mean, you can see the tired looks on these faces of some of these people who really do just look across the room at one another and are having another baby. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's number 8, 9, 10. And while every baby is a gift, there's still that mental load. Maybe mm-hmm. you really are like struggling financially, or you know, it's just your mom, your body's going to be tired at that point. You know, you've gestated all this wonderful life, but that's depleting. And I think if we have that sort of reciprocal understanding that even in this narrow category of, fertility, child rearing, marriage, that there are crosses that we all bear, and to be understanding of that on both sides. And to just understand that, not that it's, I mean, we always say like a normal person, you know, a normal couple gets pregnant within like the first year, say. We use that word normal, but it's true. Some people are just infertile. I mean, I did NAPRO technology. Mm-hmm. It didn't work for me. You know, it doesn't always work. But anyway, my long, very long-winded point is that there are infertile people, and that's normal, too.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of, you know, you draw a short straw, but, you know, I think it just shouldn't be this weird sort of scary thing for everyone. People shouldn't be ashamed or embarrassed if they are infertile, because sometimes that just happens, and they should feel free to talk about it. And then other people should sort of move beyond that initial discomfort, because people don't like to talk about sad things or uncomfortable mm-hmm. ideas. But I think if everyone just sort of relaxed, and if someone's talking about it, they're probably ready to talk about it. And so I think let that infertile person take the lead. And also, I know sometimes, especially when you're experiencing infertility, it can be really hard to understand people being like shocked and surprised and kind of worried about another pregnancy, because it's all you want in the entire world. Again, I think if we, like that word reciprocal again, like if we just understand that everyone's got their crosses to bear, I think that would facilitate these conversations, and people wouldn't be, you know, suffering so often in silence.
One of the things you highlight is that infertility looks different for every couple.
Yeah.
Like for us, the first 2 years of not conceiving, we didn't, like you said, didn't know what we didn't know. And then we saw a myriad of doctors and figured out that we had first physiological issues. Then we learned we had chemical issues.
Yeah.
And then we found out that there were friends who had completely separate issues, but they were dealing with infertility too. Mm-hmm. And we know a few couples and completely diverse issues. Can you please speak to the fact that maybe it's because of medical advancements that we know the details now, but at the same time, just speak to the fact that it looks different for different couples, but it's a real cross, and it seems to be a very widespread cross today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the big differences is that, and I think I used to be a little more harsh, because I was kind of always nurturing a little pity party for myself. Mm. You know, when somebody who married much older, say like late 30s or early 40s, you know, would be like, oh, we're experiencing infertility. Sometimes I would have like a trigger reaction. You're just old. Like, that's not the same as me. As me, it was really bad mm-hmm. for me. But it's because I was in my 20s. But really, I've just grown. I mean, writing this book was wonderful. Talking more about it, sharing the stories, hearing more stories. I really have become like totally ashamed that I ever like had those sort of feelings. Mm-hmm. And even if I hopefully didn't say them out loud. Because I think that idea that, especially when you know people who in their late 30s, early 40s have been pregnant, they've likely been pregnant before. But I mean, it's not an impossibility. Mm-hmm. And I certainly hoped I just turned 50 this past summer, and it was only recently, really, that I was able to say to myself and say out loud, I am never going to be pregnant. And so just because I started in my 20s doesn't mean that hope, you know, mm-hmm. went away after, didn't have an expiration date. And so I think, especially if you've been single and you've had this vocation to marriage, and then you finally get that, and then it's like one more mountain to traverse. You know, I just think that it's the same. And so you have that. You have male factor infertility. You have people who maybe tried, like, really, you know, who contracepted and then are experiencing it and have, you know, because the temptation and the, you know, normalized thing out there is to contracept. Everybody, you know, mm-hmm. so many people are doing it. The IUD, birth control pills, even Catholics who kind of know better feel like I can make my own medical decisions and isn't avoiding your fertile period the same as, you know, just taking a chemical, whatever. Anyway, there's lots of, like everything, you can always rationalize these things. But so if you've done that and then you go off that birth control and then you can't get pregnant, the regret you must feel and like mm-hmm. all these wasted years, because you think, wow, if we caught it earlier, then there's more time to fix it with your natural fertility. I just think there are people, you know, also there are people who are called or open to adoption. And then there are some infertile people who aren't. And I think that a lot of times we don't know what to do with those people because, you know, we think, oh, they wanted to be parents so badly. You know, here's a different way to become a parent. But I've really grown an appreciation for my friends who are married, experienced infertility, but weren't called to adopt. And I think, but they also express, like, sometimes they really do feel people don't quite know what to do with them. And they feel left out of some socializing, especially like in a parish. It's so much family-oriented things that they really have had to work hard to sort of carve out a spot for them.
In that whole milieu of working hard to carve out that space, I think one thing that I've seen is the church has begun really acknowledging that this is a part of the cross that her children carry. You know, like me and my bride too, we try to be very public. In fact, when we, after losing our first two, one of the things we committed was we were determined to talk about it. We've got about a minute left. I want to invite you to speak to the hearts of people listening.
This won't kill you. You might feel like it will, but it won't. And if you look around, you'll see the many fruits that people bear. Celibate people are called to be fruitful. Older people who are past the pregnancy stage are still called to be fruitful. It's not a box you check, and we should really not reduce our innate nature as mothers and our call to be fruitful to only babies, because there are so many fruits that we can bear. And I really think sometimes, for me, one thing I did was, which really helped me, was I was so pleased that I had my husband and relied on him so much during those infertile years, intensive, and I always would offer up my suffering to women for prayers, like to find a husband, women who really wanted to find a husband, because again, everyone has their cross, and to sort of connect with that, I think, lightens your own load.
Leigh, tremendous joy and an honor. I'm looking forward to future conversations. God bless you. My guest has been Leigh Sneed. She's the author of an amazing book, Infertile But Fruitful, Finding Fulfillment When You Can't Conceive. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Step away from the noise and return to what truly matters at Maryville Retreat Center in Holly. From retreats for married couples and those discerning their vocation, to directed silent retreats and evening prayer services, even exploring scripture through art, Maryville offers sacred space to rest, pray, and renew your spirit individually or as a family. Visit their website at maryvilleretreatcenter.org or call 248-634-5566.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
We lived in a neighborhood for 13 years and knew few of our neighbors. Most stayed to themselves. Being very social people, this was odd for my family, but we accepted it. When we moved into a new neighborhood, we quickly got to know many neighbors. In less than a year, we knew more about our new neighbors than we ever did the old neighbors. However, there is one particular neighbor who seemed very unfriendly, but we waved to him anyway and we talked to him when possible. He's brief in his commentary, but we smile and wave. He once wrote a couple of terse post-it notes to my husband over something very silly, but we didn't allow it to change the way we treat him. We're still kind. How many of you know your neighbors? Knowing them, asking about them, is loving them. We're all called to love our neighbors, and we can communicate love of our neighbor by first getting to know them, and through our kindness, we can evangelize the faith. This has been a Christ Center communication message. I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, a communications evangelist and host of Epiphany.
On the next Epiphany.
Hi, Vanessa Denha-Garmo here. Dr. Horace Buchholz from the Archdiocese of Detroit will be here to promote a special organ festival this spring at the Cathedral of the Most Blessed Sacrament. And Kelly Solomon with the Cardinal Newman Society is here to talk about the new edition of their Newman Guide, helping families navigate higher Catholic education.
Epiphany, weekdays at noon on Ave Maria Radio.
Steve and Janet Ray here, announcing we are back in the Holy Land, ready to introduce you to our favorite places in the world, the land where God walked. Mass at the most holy sites, pray the mysteries of the Rosary where they happened, and experience the Bible in vivid color. We have led over 100 groups through this land, sharing the whole story of salvation. Of all the pilgrimages in all of the world, this is the one you should not miss.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at avemariaradio.net. Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Resetting your password, unsubscribing from emails, printing anything. Why are simple things sometimes so complicated? Thankfully, with an auto owner's insurance independent agent, getting the right coverage for your business doesn't have to be one of them, so you can get back to more important things, like learning how that printer works. That's simple human sense.
Call Choice Insurance Agency at 734-641-4200.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Some time ago, I was blessed to sit down with my dear friends Greg and Lisa Popchek of More to Life and Ave Maria Radio and EWTN, and I had given a talk called Satan's 12 Attacks on Marriage. We have that list for you on avemariaradio.net. The day after the talk, Greg and Lisa and I spoke with each other about different parts of that list and how Satan really does act out those 12 areas. Let's go on to that conversation.
Satan's 12 attacks on marriage. The first is the divorce mentality that even Catholic couples get into marriage with an escape hatch, the back door is open. I invite you to comment on that.
It's part of what St. John Paul referred to as the disposable culture. You know, when I'm done with this thing, then I should just get rid of it. And the same thing is true. You know, I will be with you for as long as you're useful to me. And when you stop being, at least in my mind, useful to me, then we move on. But I think that underneath that is that we all love our comfort zones more than we love each other.
Mm.
Right? And so the sacramental grace of marriage challenges us to move past that. But if you don't have that sacramental mindset, then everybody comes to a point in a marriage where I'm as comfortable as I'm ever going to be with you. And if I'm going to have a closer relationship with you, I have to be willing to risk being uncomfortable.
Uh-huh.
And most people don't want to do that, right? And I don't have a reason to do that. I finally got to a place where I'm comfortable, and I'm going to sit here very well. You know, yeah. But having that escape hatch, it's really about, you know, I've gotten to the place where I, in order to be closer, I would need to be uncomfortable to get there, and that feels wrong somehow. That feels uncomfortable, right? And so I guess that means that we're done. You know, whereas with a sacramental mindset, we're able to say, you know, God gave you to me so that I'd be uncomfortable, so that I'd grow in ways that I'd never grow if you weren't part of my life, and vice versa, right? And by saying yes to the things that you're asking from me, by saying yes to the needs that he's placed in your heart, especially when it causes me to stretch and grow and change, God is giving me an invitation through you, you know, to grow in ways that just don't come naturally to me, and vice versa. But if I don't have that mindset from the beginning, then it doesn't make sense. Why would I, you know, we've gone as far as we can go. We're done now, right? But if I have that sacramental mindset, I realize, wait, there's supposed to be more than just our comfort at stake. But that's why the escape hatch is so important for so many people, because if I don't have that escape hatch, then I don't have a reason to be uncomfortable with you.
As you're saying that, and it's just so, so true, I think that, you know, we get very committed to our comfort zones. But there's also this idea of, I married you to aggrandize me, to build me up, to make me feel wonderful, to make me feel spectacular. Mm. And while there is part of that in Christian marriage, because you want to build that person up in terms of, I'm going to help you to become more virtuous. I'm going to help you grow closer to Christ. I'm going to let you see how much God loves you through my eyes. But that's not aggrandizing of that person and all of their faults. That's saying, let's go toward the light. Let's go toward Christ, and let's grow to be more like him, not more of our worst selves. And so if you have somebody who enters into marriage not understanding the sacramentality of it, and they want to be aggrandized by their spouse. And then over time, their spouse starts having needs of their own, or needs to be built up a little bit in their own right because they've been giving so much, or whatever that is. It doesn't only make you uncomfortable, it shatters your idea of the false god that you are. And so you want to get out, because that hurts and that's scary. And unless we really understand the sacramentality of it, and we're participating in the sacraments of the church, we don't have a way to sort that out, besides running up.
I'd love to dive into that, but I just want to move through as much as possible. The pornography thing. Every time someone calls about this issue, you present this as not an individual problem, but a couple issue to deal with together.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very easy to say, okay, the spouse, and it's usually the husband, mm-hmm. but sometimes it can be the woman as well, and women are using pornography more than ever. But to say, you know, the person who is viewing pornography, they're the problem. They're the pornography addict. And so it's their problem. They should go off and get fixed. At the heart of the sin of lust, there's a divine longing for communion. I talk about this in my book, Broken Gods, where I look at the seven deadly sins. And so the seven deadly sins are actually twistings, Satan's kind of perversion of seven divine longings that each of us have. And so, you know, each of us longs to be known and in communion with another person, especially in a particularly intimate way, right? A lot of us, you know, we have wounds that make that hard to do, right? We have wounds that make it hard for us to give ourselves to another. We have wounds that make it difficult for us to receive the other. And so pornography fills that gap very often. It gives me the illusion of communion without all the work, without having to heal those wounds. If a person is going to really recover from pornography use, they have to do work on their relationships. And you really can't work on relationship by yourself.
Uh-huh.
That's not to say that it's your spouse's fault in any way that you're using pornography. That's your choice, right? Mm-hmm. We are responsible for our own choices. But we can be responsible for healing, for each other's healing, whatever those wounds are. And the sacrament of marriage is meant to force those wounds to the surface so that God can deal with them and so God can heal them. And so when we run into those things, instead of being kind of shocked and appalled that those sins are there and those weaknesses and wounds are there, they're serious. We have to recognize them for what they are. But to be able to face them together and learn how can we learn to love each other through this and heal each other from this so that we can give and receive ourselves to each other the way God wants us to, as opposed to settling for something that will fill the gap without us having to do that work.
You know, it's too long to go into, but truly that the root of this is in attachment in childhood, mm-hmm. where people have not had enough of their needs of I'm loved, I'm accepted, I'm cherished, met by the adults in their lives, the parents in their lives, grandparents who are supposed to be there and be the first face of God to their children. And that's most of us now for a zillion reasons. That's not any, no parent in the world ever sets out to not fill the cup of their child. Mm-hmm. But that's happening more for women now than it's ever happened before. Because men, as little boys, were always sort of like, they could be cuddled till they were like two or three. And then you know, they had to, you know, go hang out with the guys and go play sports and get pushed away a little bit. And so for years we saw the effect of that as pornography being more of a man's thing. Now the same thing is happening to girls. You know, get out there and succeed and do these things and daycare and I don't have time to hug you and I don't, you know, a lot of the same exact thing is happening. And so we're seeing the same rise, unfortunately, with women. But either way, and I think with men being the ones who it's been such a high number of for so long, you know, women have really, at least in the church, have come to acknowledge that when their husband is engaging in pornography, it is a ripping of your heart because it is so akin to being cheated on.
Because that's what it is.
It is. It is. And for a long time, people wouldn't let women acknowledge that because there was no human contact, you know. But it is in our souls and in everything we are. It is. But in being able to acknowledge the pain of that now, if the man is willing and repentant you can really work on healing the attachment wounds of either one of you, because we know how to do that more than ever. So there is hope.
And I just, you know, I appreciate the awareness that has occurred because of the kind of treating pornography as an addiction issue. I think the downside of that is, and we run into this in the practice a lot, is where, you know, men are being sent off by their wives to go and get fixed. And the answer then is that the man just tries really hard to just not have those feelings anymore. Mm-hmm. That's not his helping his relationship skills. That's not helping, you know. And so, you know, we'll meet the person there. But the goal is then to try to bring the spouse in so that they can work through their relationship stuff, so that they can learn to give and receive each other as fully as they possibly can to heal that wound. And again, I'm not blaming the spouse for that pornography issue. That's the pornography user's choice, and that's their sin. But the solution is very much rooted in relationship, not so much the addiction model.
What you're listening to is a conversation I had with Dr. Greg and Lisa Popchick on the Good News Cruise about Satan's 12 attacks on marriage. We have that list on avimariaradio.net, and we are continuing this conversation on the other side of the break. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
No one should ever have to choose between feeding their family and keeping their heat on. Impossible questions like rent or diapers demand answers every day, likely in your very own neighborhood, but you can help. Hope Clinic partners with you to provide free medical, dental, food, and behavioral health care, all in Jesus' name. While others face impossible choices, your choice is an easy one. Partner with Hope Clinic today. Find out how at www.thehopeclinic.org.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchick.
Good family discussions don't just happen, they take time. Family talk rituals help families be intentional about making real conversations happen. You need to be intentional if you want to get past exchanges like, "What'd you do in school today?" "Nothing." Believe it or not, when the relationship between parents and kids is healthy, kids naturally want to open up to mom and dad. Kids want to know that their parents care enough to take time to listen and to understand how they're feeling and what they're going through. When parents make time to listen first, kids are more likely to willingly receive what mom and dad have to say. That's why family talk rituals are an important part of Catholic family life. To discover more ways your family can celebrate the liturgy of domestic church life, check out the newest editions of Parenting with Grace and visit CatholicCounselors.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Who took Jesus' life? No one took Jesus' life, according to the Catholic Catechism. Jesus freely gave up his life and took it up again. He knew his passion and death were the instruments of his Father's redemptive plan, that this was his Father's desire, and thus it was his desire. At the Last Supper, Jesus made a memorial of his voluntary offering to his Father when he instituted the Eucharist. He made his apostles the priests of the new covenant when he told them to perpetuate the memorial. The Catechism tells us in suffering and death, his humanity became the free and perfect instrument of his divine love, which desires the salvation of men. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
You're listening to Ave Maria Radio.
Ave Maria Radio.
Support for this Ave Maria Radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org. Or 877-LIFE-US1.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is.
Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Some time ago on the Good News Cruise, I was blessed to talk with Dr. Greg and Lisa Popchick about Satan's 12 attacks on marriage. And I'm going to continue that conversation. In this segment, we launch into the concept of radical individualism and how that destroys marriages from the get-go. Let's go on to the conversation.
I talked yesterday about this radical self-centeredness of the modern narrative, modern man. And maybe we can merge that with that concept of a contraceptive mentality. And I'm not talking about NFP, just generally, you know, children are something to be protected from because they take away from your freedom, your autonomy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that going back to Lisa's point about attachment wounds, right? Okay, so for folks who don't know, attachment is formed in the first 5 years of life, and it's basically the degree to which when I call out, somebody's going to respond to me, and it creates this very deep, not just psychological but biological sense, like the something around the nerves called a myelin sheath. And the myelin sheath actually, it's like the insulation on an extension cord. And it's what enables electrical impulses to travel down the nerve cell quickly. If I have an extension cord that's frayed, right, what happens? It sparks, smokes, it's not efficient, it's not delivering the electricity down the line. When you have a very thin myelin sheath, the same thing is happening inside of you. And whenever you experience, especially affection or intimacy, your social brain short circuits because you don't have the thick myelin sheath around that. The way that myelin sheath develops is through affection, especially in the first 5 years. And so when you have somebody who, you know, who doesn't receive that kind of affection and affirmation that they need, especially in the early years, intimacy feels threatening to them. It feels overwhelming to them. And so the idea of raising a child, when I have so many of my own needs and hurt, like giving myself to another person is painful, like not just on a psychological level, but on a physical level, if I have attachment wounds. Because physically, I just don't physically have it to give. Mm. So the idea of having this child who I now need to give all this affection and love to, it feels threatening on a neurological level, Ooh. Not just a psychological one.
Well, to add to that, I think the secondary terror in that is I need that attention. I need that attachment to my spouse. What do you mean I have to share this person with somebody else?
Oh.
So suddenly your spouse, and we see it on both sides. You know, I have seen so many women who say, my husband loves the kids more than he loves me. He spends all this time with them, he pays attention to them, he thinks they're so delightful, and now suddenly I'm second. And certainly in men, what do you mean she's exhausted at the end of the day? She's given everything to the kids. What do I get? And so there's a terror in folks who have been wired, as Greg is saying here, that maybe I can love my spouse and they can love me and we can be equal and we can keep each other safe, but when we start adding a child, that's terrifying. But maybe I can have one, because as our society now has coined the term, that can be my mini-me, and I can be aggrandized kind of through raising this person to be as perfect as I want to be. But then you start adding more than one, and that gets really real, because you have to negotiate, and you have to share love with two people, and you have to open your heart more. And opening your heart more when it's been so damaged is terrifying. So we have to protect ourselves from that. And I thought you said that so brilliantly last night when you asked the group, you know, how when we talk about contraception, what do we call it? And we call it protection. And we're thinking protection against what? Protection against the terror of having to not be loved enough, of having to share love with yet more human beings and not ever getting that wound.
And that, therefore, feeds into things like busyness, exhaustion, distraction, financial anxiety, the material way in which we are convinced to live. I mean, every person here has gone through different levels of financial anxiety. Let's talk about kind of the sexual confusion that's happening in the culture right now, the undermining of difference, male and female, fatherhood and motherhood.
You know, I think The reason that Christ received so many wounds is to heal all the wounds that we are all walking around with. Mm-hmm. As we talk about, you know, what we've been talking about for the last few minutes within men and women as God created us, and the more we experience more wounding in our society, less attachment. You know, I know very few people who are able to make the financial sacrifice to have one parent in the home when their children are small anymore. Our society is setting us up for incredible attachment wounds. Mm-hmm. And so much of the gender confusion, so much of all that we're seeing going on in the world is just wounded inner children screaming for somebody to teach them that they're loved, to give them a sense of order, to tell them that they're going to be okay, and it's just spinning out of control in a way that Satan is just attacking us on every front and then turning us against each other when anybody tries to say, hey, there's a better way. There's a way to heal.
You know, we've seen the breakdown of what it means to be a man and woman in general. And so kids who are growing up don't have clear models for what a healthy sense of masculinity or femininity actually looks like. They recognize that they don't necessarily always fit inside the caricature of what masculinity or femininity should be. And so they don't know where they fit. Mm-hmm. And so there's a narrative that comes along that says, well, you fit, you're non-binary, or, you know, you fit in this way.
Right, you don't fit, transgender. You fit, yeah.
You know, the secular world has a story for them that makes them feel heard and mm-hmm. seen. I think that Christians kind of buy into, well, not buy into it, but accidentally feed this when we have these sort of very stereotypical kind of ideas. It is very true that men and women are different, but it can be difficult to speak of those differences intelligently. And when we try to speak of them in very broad terms, what ends up happening is we end up with these caricatures that some people don't fit into. Mm-hmm. And what we end up communicating is, well, you're less of a man and you're less of a woman. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, you know, for example, what St. John Paul said, you know, you know, it's not being a man or a woman isn't really about the things that you like or the things that you prefer or the jobs that you do. It's about serving the other through the body that God gave you. And, you know, as a man, my masculinity shines out when I serve others, especially my wife, through the body that God gave me. And her femininity shines out when she serves others through the body that gave her. And so, you know, that's a very broad definition, right? But it's a very affirming definition, mm-hmm. too, because there are a lot of, you know, men in particular who don't fit the kind of classic caricature of what masculinity is, but they're no less masculine, right, than the men who do. And because as long as both men serve others through the masculine body that God gave them, and so that broad understanding of masculinity or femininity that St. John Paul put forth in the theology of the body, I think, is very freeing. Yeah. But I don't think anybody, even most Catholics, don't know that.
That actually is very good. So I guess as a final thing, then, just considering the reality that we all exist at different levels of family life, third-party intrusion, forgetting about the fact that there is an intrinsic union of this marriage and family.
I mean, I think, again, because we're not teaching couples what marriage is supposed to be, like, for example, there are a lot of people who believe that your spouse shouldn't be your best friend because women can't be men's best friend, or men can't be women's best friend because we're just different, right? And so women should find that fellowship with other women, and men should find that fellowship with other men, right? You know, we don't. You know, that's a very popular Christian belief,
wow.
Believe it or not.
Meanwhile, the two have become one, so
yeah.
We better be able to share everything together.
But that's not. I mean, like, a lot of Christians really bought into the kind of John Gray Mars and Venus.
Oh
thing,
yeah, yeah,
right,
yeah,
right,
yeah,
right,
yeah, yeah. I that book, yeah.
Right, and you know, and some of it makes sense because there are very big differences between men and women, but we're different for each other, not different from each other.
Uh-huh.
But I think that a lot of Christians, Catholics and Protestants, kind of buy into the idea that no, we're different from each other. Therefore, we can't. You know, we can get along as best as we can, but ultimately, we're going to find our support elsewhere.
I think that this is especially true for trying to remain close as an extended family in this crazy culture we have in the United States, where we no longer stay in the same neighborhood. We no longer stay in the same village. You know, when my mother was growing up, all of her aunts and uncles and cousins all lived in the same apartment building in New York City. So if her mother needed a break, she'd say, go upstairs and hang out with Aunt Mary. You don't have that anymore. And so parents of adult children who have gotten married desperately want to hold the family together. They miss their children. They want to see their grandchildren. And it's getting more, it had become more and more difficult to do all of that because of distance, because of kids moving away. But I think that if we do as what Greg said, look at ourselves as how can we support our adult children in being the best couple they can be, in learning to love God together, in supporting them and raising their children to feel supported by us so they don't have to do it all alone, but also support them in raising their children to be Catholic. That's very different than, what do you mean we're going to do Christmas at your house because you have three kids under the age of five and they want to open presents under their own Christmas tree? We've always done it this way.
Right.
Our priest took us aside, actually rode with us to our rehearsal dinner because he knew something was up with our, with both sides of our family. And he said, there's one thing I want you to know before we get out of this car. Tomorrow, when I pronounce you man and wife, you are each other's family. Everybody else just becomes your support system. And if they can support you in loving God and each other, they can be let in. And if they're not supporting you in loving God and each other, then you have to kind of temper when you can let them in and how you can let them in. And it was very important to us because it's two very young, newly married people. We were used to being part of those families.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly somebody who we admired and who helped us enter into the sacrament of marriage was telling us, no. The point from here on in is that two have become one and helping each other be everything you can be in this life. And that's the purpose that we as parents of adult children have to support and encourage. And that doesn't mean we drop out. It means we say, in everything we're asking of our children, everything we want to do with our children, oh, I'd love to have the whole family go to the zoo on Saturday if you live close enough. Does that work for you and the kids? Does that work for your schedule? Or do you need something else from us? So it's not demands. It's not pressure. It's we love you. We support you. We want to spend time with you.
Mm-hmm.
But how can we also make that work for you guys? Because you're the ones in the trenches now.
You know, that's about as beautiful a place to end this. Greg, Lisa, thank you for your time.